You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, and actually tonight's episode just came together about a couple of hours ago. Our special guest today is Emsh of the Subatomic Sound System, and I've vaguely known Emsh for about a decade now, but we don't actually know each other that well. So we're going to open up with a brand new song off his brand new album, which is absolutely fantastic. The new album is billed as Michael Rose, Holly Cook. Of course, you all know Holly Cook, daughter of Paul Cook of the Sex Pistols, but she's a reggae artist in her own right, as well as Subatomic Sound System. So this is the title track, and it's awesome. Rocking Like a Champion with the icon, Michael Rose, and of course Subatomic Sound System, including Emsh. And we'll be right back. Know a little bit about our background, and I don't even know if you remember me, but we put out at Punk News a couple of cassette tapes, and I guess about 7 years ago you were very generous and let us put on your amazing single with Aria. It's actually a double single. The A side, Subatomic Sound System, Lee Scratch Perry, Aria up doing Hello, Hell Is Very Low, which is a really cool track, and also like one of the few times that Lee Scratch Perry kind of has almost a goth concept in his lyrics, you know, which is really cool. And the flip side, kind of like the positive track, it's Ari up talking about how much she likes to have sex to an amazing beat. It's called Bed Athletes. Yeah. And we had that on our cassette tape. And so I reviewed a couple of your releases here and there. We've never really spoken.
Yeah. But,
one time Lee Scratch Perry and Subatomic Sound System played Baltimore and I came down and I dropped off the cassette tape. Did you ever get the cassette tape is the question.
Yeah, I did. I think I just recently was moving and was looking through a box and I think I came across it. And you know, it's funny because I forgot that that track was on there because it only came out on vinyl and I've actually been meaning to put it out like in some sort of special way, you know, on her birthday or something like that over the years and have just been distracted. But it's a special track. We had a great time making it.
That is really special, and we'll play that at the end. And we're going to talk about Ari. We're going to talk about Lee Scratch Perry. We're going to talk about the brand new Michael Rhodes album. But actually, you connect with the punk news world in a way that I'm not even sure you know you connect, but maybe you do know. You did sound production on Crazy Ballhead's compilation record, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
So of course, Crazy Ballhead is Agent J of J and the Slackers and Agent 99, Vic of the Slackers. So do you know the whole Slackers New York crew, all those guys? Like, you know those guys? Or?
Oh, yeah. In fact, literally just yesterday, I was mixing a tune off their forthcoming album, and I mixed some tunes last summer for them that were supposed to come out as instrumental sort of dubs, but then one of them came out, Vic liked it so much he wanted to record vocals over it, so they put out a new version of the tune State House last summer. It was the flip side of a single called Kill You. We've known each other forever because when I started Subatomic, my partner starting it with Noah was really tight with those guys, and he was the bass player in King Django's band and Stubborn All-Stars, so it was all sort of a family thing. He introduced me to all those guys, like Victor Rice was originally part of Subatomic Sound System. So yeah, I know the Slackers really well, and in fact, Glenn Pine from the Slackers, the trombone player and singer, I spend a lot of time with him because we live near each other now, so yeah.
So are you from the New York area originally?
As a kid, I grew up in Seattle, and then I moved out to. I was in Philly for a few years, and from Philly, I basically I went out of the country for like a year, and then moved up to New York. I lived most of my life in New York City. So,
Were you in Philadelphia? What years was that?
I was in West Philly and downtown Philly in like the early 90s. Yeah.
So, do you know all the West Philly punks from that time period?
Possibly some, definitely some. I mean, that was a very influential time in my life. And like it was more like the downtown scene. Like there was a label called Compulsive and a group called Zen Gorilla that was very like influential on me in terms of they were kind of inspired by like the Butthole Surfers or something, which I wasn't that up on. But it was like. They used a lot of delay and a lot of really crazy experimental stuff that at the time kind of opened my mind up to like I'd heard some Lee Perry stuff back then, but it was like kind of a door opening to dub. I was experimenting with like I had a band called Scorched Earth Affair, and it was kind of like some sludgy, grungy, dubby experimental stuff. So but when you say the punks of West Philly, you got to tell me who you're talking about.
Did you know guys like Greg Daly, or did you know like Dan Yemin, or I'm trying to think who else? You know,
are those like the Meat Puppets guys, or
Dead Milkman guys were
Dead Milkman guys. Sure. I mean, yeah, no, I don't know those guys by name, but I mean, I was living in West Philly. There was there's that little venue below Billy Bob's, the cheesesteak place that I remember a lot of bands were playing for a minute, but.
Maybe Cousin Danny's?
No, I don't remember. But like I said, we were playing like Khyber Pass, and I kind of got familiar with a lot of those bands. There was a band called Dandelion that was kind of like a proto Stooges type band that had gotten pretty popular and signed to Rough House Records. And I think they thought they were going to be kind of like Nirvana type thing. It never really happened. But I remember they were very cool and recorded some demos for us, and kind of you know, some of those guys were a little bit of like mentors to my crew before we like moved to New York.
So you moved up to New York, and is that where you got involved in like ska, reggae, and dub, or were you already involved in ska, reggae, and dub before that?
No, you know, I was listening to a lot of it. In fact, back in might have been even before like 1990. It might have been 1989. I went to a Black Uhuru show, and Michael Rose was not in the band at the time. And it was in Atlanta. I went to college for a year in Atlanta, and yeah, so I was like listening to reggae, and I was curious about it. And at one point, I dated a woman who's from DC, and DC had a big there's kind of a big connection there, right, between the reggae and punk scene. I was real into, you know, Minor Threat and Fugazi, and of course, like Bad Brains was part of that. And there was just a big Caribbean community, like supposedly, you know, Bob Marley had lived in Baltimore at one point, and so I would go out to clubs there and saw like live reggae for the first time, you know, played by like Jamaicans. And, you know, of course, like Bad Brains, really, like that was my introduction to reggae. I was hearing that even younger and didn't even know what it was. I was like skating back when I was a kid in Seattle. And I remember that at the skate ramps, they would play like songs like Sailing On or Pay to Come. And it was because it was just like so fast and so hard. I remember I still have like almost like seeing a video in my mind of like certain people I knew like skating on ramps at competitions, those songs. But occasionally the tape would keep playing and the reggae song would come on, and, you know, someone would jump to like fast forward it usually because they just want more like fast hard stuff at the skate ramp. But I remember thinking, oh, what is this music now, like the bass lines and the echoes, like it almost reminded me of Black Sabbath, which, you know, up in Seattle people listen to that type of stuff a lot. So that was kind of like the precursor to a lot of the grunge bands up there. But yeah, so that's a little bit of how I, you know, absorbed a little bit of reggae along the way from Seattle, Atlanta, DC, and New York is where I really got into this specific scene of all the people we're talking about now, though, as a person playing the music.
What one last, like, it's like really old school question then, and then, like, do you know a lot of, I guess, like the Slackers Orbit, like, do you know Arab Babajian? Or do you even know, like, I mean, do you know, not, do you even know, do you know Alec of Agent 99? Or do you even know, like, the Leftover Crack guys? Or was that not quite your scene?
No. I was, like, a little outside. It was more like the guys who got into reggae. You know, I'm like, I know Django well. We did, like, some mm-hmm. remix of Subatomic Sound System, like, remixes for Django. And we'd go over to his studio and stuff. Like I said, I know Victor Rice. I know Agent J really well from back then, because he and Noah were playing together in King Django's band. So like Dave Hahn, I know, I think he played in like Skinner Box and Mephiscopheles and some of those bands. I didn't even know about that he was in some of those bands at the time, because by the time I met him, he was in Dub as a Weapon playing with other people I knew, like Benny Herson, who I guess he was in a ska band. So it's a lot of the guys from that early ska scene, like I met after they moved on and did other stuff, and I didn't learn until years later that they were kind of part of that scene, or even that they were in bands that I knew, but I just didn't know who was in them because I wasn't there at that time. You know,
one of the very many neat things that Emsh was a part of was, I guess, one of the resurrections of Lee Scratch Perry's career. And if the listeners probably know, if they don't know, if you ask me, Lee Scratch Perry, maybe the greatest artist of all time, maybe the greatest reggae artist of all time, greatest producer of all time. He produced many iconic reggae recordings, War in Babylon, Police and Thieves, Heart of the Congos. He also produced a lot of the first, I guess, classic era, if you will, Bob Marley and the Wailers. But he also has a whole bunch of really great solo records, Super 8, which is, I guess, more like a posse record, if you will, but also Roast Fish and Hollywood and Cornbread. But I think, Emsh, I think you would agree that Perry's career, especially post Black Ark, which was his studio that collapsed in like 79 or so, yeah, up and down, very up and down. And if you ask me, Paul Emsh, one of his great contributions to music was one of the many resurrections of Perry's career with Return from Planet Dub, which also had Ari Up of the Slits on it. And there's kind of two versions of that record. There's a double CD version and a single disc vinyl version. They're both awesome. You should both check them out. But how did you link up? How did you link up with Perry? And how did that come about? How did that come about?
Oh, well, that album you just mentioned is exactly how I linked with Perry, because the band Double Standard, who did that album, they're from Vienna, Austria. And I think we somehow were working together with someone who did like radio promotions or something for both of us. And Paul Zaski, the leader of the band, was in New York. And you, someone told him to link with me. And so he came by, and I think at the time, actually, he was playing me some stuff they're working on, and included some other stuff with Ari too, because I think I at the time had been working with Ari up. She was just getting the slits back together, and which interestingly, Holly Cook was part of that, which is my original connection to Holly Cook was through Ari up. But anyway, Paul was playing me some of this stuff, and they needed a guitar player at the time for some tour dates in Canada. And so I went on tour with them, and just in the process of driving around in the van, I was playing things I was working on, and they heard some of this more electronic dub that I was working on. It basically sounded like dubstep, and they're like, oh, this sounds like this dubstep thing going on in the UK. And I was like, oh yeah, you know, it's like I kind of came from listening to like drum and bass. I mean, you know, to me, actually, like evolution wise I was just thinking about your whole publication, Punk, and my own evolution and connection to that. Like, to me, punk is kind of an approach to things, and in many ways, like Lee Perry is the most punk of all artists, which I think is why he was adopted. So, I mean, he wrote the song Punky Reggae with Lee Perry, but, you know, obviously the Clash and all the UK punks just loved Perry. And he kind of embraced like their style as well. But, you know, that whole idea of like doing things on your own, doing it your own way. Perry like built his own studio in the backyard of his house, you know, had his own record label, all that kind of thing. Like, to me, that was kind of the approach. You know, Subatomic Sound, we did that too. We got about a crew of people. We were, you know, getting our own equipment together. And at the time, like recording equipment was just changing over to be computer based. And I was able to get like samplers, and a lot of things that had been really expensive were cheaper now, that once you could just get them in the computer. And so we started experimenting with a lot of different kinds of music. Like when I first moved to New York, I had a band that was more like, kind of influenced by New York bands like Quicksand and, you know, DC groups like Fugazi and stuff. And that's how I actually came across Noah, as looking for a bass player who knew stuff beyond that genre. And he came from that reggae scene. And we started making music together as Subatomic, which was, you know, had like loosely based in a lot of things we were interested in. And it was like very open. And to me, that's the other thing too, like punk. It's one of the things that makes me crazy about the idea of like pop punk is one of the most like oxymoron things I can think of, because to me it was like punk was there's also an element of just being contrary to what's common and mainstream and normal, and just kind of not having boundaries. And I think that was one of the things with Subatomic too. Like we never intended to be making reggae specifically. We were just like experimenting with all kinds of stuff, and that's what was exciting about it, you know. And I think that's what when I think back was initially exciting to me when I heard stuff that, you know, I didn't even know, like I said, what was punk or reggae or dub at the time. It's just when you're hearing all these new sounds. And later, it's like when someone writes the history of it, it kind of gets categorized. You know what I'm saying?
Sure, definitely. With Perry, I got to interview him twice, and I was always kind of proud of myself in that.
And that's a challenge, right? It's a challenge. Well, Steve,
what I noticed with Perry, and I mean, you knew Perry way better than I do, so I'm very interested in your perspective here, is a lot of interviews would say, so Scratch, you know, what's the deal with the new album? And he'd be like, I'm a fish, and then I become the sun. And the interviewer would fall for it, if you will. Like, you're a fish, Lee? And he'd be like, yes, I'm a fish, and I swim. And I was proud that when I kind of got some guidance from who wrote People Funny Boy? What's his name? David Katz,
yeah.
Right. And I knew that you could refuse that answer and get the real person, you know? Yeah. And so I asked him, so, you know, Perry, you've got this new album. What's the deal? And he'd be like, I'm a fish, blah, blah, blah. And he'd say, yeah, but who, like, when you were recording, you know, with Max Romeo in 76, who was on bass? And then he would, like, give you a real answer. I was always pleased that you were able to kind of force him to be real and not be this character. So who to you was the real Lee Scratch Perry, you know?
Well, you know, he was, like, more than anything, like, a comedian, you know? He loved to, like, joke, you know. There's a side that there's definitely people who expected him to be like this spiritual mystic figure, which was absolutely a side of him, but he could be different people at different times, you know? And I think like you need to accept all of that. There's a side of him that's a genius, and there's a side of him that is like just flawed and really like difficult person and self-destructive and things like that. And to be honest, like Adrian Sherwood gave me a lot of advice about how to deal with Lee. I have to credit him for, you know, kind of like you said, you talked to David Katz before talking to him, like early on, you know, I did a few shows with Double Standard with Lee Perry. Like the very first show we ever did, actually, Ari Up came and sang. There's a video somewhere on YouTube of us performing in Brooklyn. It's right next to the Gowanus Canal, the place that doesn't exist anymore. It was called Gowanus Yard, I think. Brooklyn Yard. Brooklyn Yard, it was called. A friend of ours ran it. And we did this all day party. It was like a secret event happening the day before we were going to play at Central Park, which was the real reason he was there, because they booked us to play there. But somehow, because the woman who ran Brooklyn Yard connected us with Central Park, they made some exception that he could do like a unbilled show there. So we played. It was almost like playing someone's backyard barbecue. It was amazing. And Lee showed up late, straight off a plane from Germany, and the sun was going down. I think the permit was only through sunset, and it was after dark, basically, by the time he showed up. And we played for like a while, and people were like, everyone thought he wasn't going to show. There was like a rumor he was supposed to be there, so a lot of people did actually show up. But then people started to leave because they're like, ah, it's over, he's not going to show up. And they showed up, and it was crazy. I think it was like the last song or two, like he and Ari Epp came and did a version of Truth and Rights, which was great. There's a video of it that I just recently like dug up the other day to see if it was still around.
So what was it like working with Perry in the studio? Was it like you two sitting side by side and working on stuff? Was it him showing up and you building stuff around it? What was it like working with Perry in the studio, particularly for Super 8 Returns to Conquer,
Yeah,
which is a
well,
very cool. Go ahead.
thanks, man. I mean, to be honest, we spent the most time side by side, like in the car or sitting on planes together on tour, because most of the time we were together was just on tour, and we would record the shows, and he loved to listen back to them in the car, and talk about them. And a lot of times he was like writing, coming up with lyric ideas, or in the car he would talk to us about song ideas. And that's often we would talk about like what we're going to play. He always wanted to do different things every night, you know. When I first got hit up to work with him, they wanted me to do a thing like he did with Mad Professor, just me and him. And I thought, especially because the first thing we did for them on that Double Standard record was some remixes that were basically like dubstep, like electronic. And he was always trying to do new stuff and push forward. And they wanted to do a tour just like that. And I, like, as a fan of his, and also, you know, having been to shows of his before that I was like disappointed by, like, I wanted to put on the show that as a fan I would have wanted to see. And so I said, listen, I think it's cool to do this new stuff, but at the same time, like, people showing up, they want to hear what like you're famous for, you know. And at first, like, he's like, nah, I didn't really want to do it. So I convinced him we need to bring a horn section. On bass, we had Paul from Double Standard, because he was my initial connection to Lee. So he, for many years, was touring as a bass player. And then on percussion, we had Larry McDonald, who had worked with Scratch. They're basically the same age. Larry just turned 88, I think, a few months ago, and
And he looks like he's about 60 or something. It's crazy.
Exactly. He's like fronting the Scatolites now as well, like singing and playing percussion with them. So yeah, I mean, he's phenomenal. And so like that was really important to have that balance of all people who are familiar with Lee and that chemistry. And so I think that had a lot to do with like the longevity of us working with them, is everyone just like got along really well and enjoyed being together, and was able to kind of work around when he would, you know, be crazy or difficult. I mean, there would be times he'd be very unpredictable. I was just thinking the other day about this time after we had a great show and a great night, and everyone's in a good mood, and we were driving down the highway at like 2 a.m., I think maybe from Baltimore to Philly even, and he just started punching the window of the car, and he used to wear all these metal rings just as hard as he could. Like, it was like someone was hitting the car window with a sledgehammer while we're going, like, you know, 70 miles an hour down the highway in the middle of the night. And I remember Larry being, like, shouting at him, like, Lee, my youth, you know, chill, relax, man. What are you doing? And then Lee, like, cursed at Larry. And everyone was just like, oh, we don't even know what to do in this situation. Why is he doing this? It's really weird. And then he stopped. He stopped. But, you know, there was just, like, times like that. So I know your question was about recording, but I just had to kind of give you the context of really, like, most of the time in the relationship we developed was all through just, you know, like, when I think back on Scratch, more than even thinking about times on stage, I think of, like, just times we're sitting in the car talking about stuff, or at a restaurant, or just sit around the hotel laughing about things. Like I say, like to joke around. But when we did get down to recording for that album, we already had been playing a lot of the songs live, which is when I proposed to him. I realized, like, the anniversary of the album was coming up. I was like, oh, why don't we just put together the rest of these songs and, like, record a new rendition, because a lot of people were interested in the way we were playing the songs with them, which was different than how they originally were, but still it had elements of the originals, but also had something new that made them a little more, like, lively and vibrant and connect with a younger audience. Like, one of the best reviews I felt we got on that album was a guy, a German magazine called Rhythm, and, you know, Germans are, like, famously rigid about, like, what they'll accept as, you know, reggae, or, you know, the abomination of people perverting old reggae to not, you know, be authentic or something. So it can be pretty challenging to get something positive out of them. And the reviewer said he listened to the album and he really liked it, but he at first didn't really think that it sounded that much different from the original. And then he went back and listened to the 1976 album, and he said he was shocked because he realized that the new album sounded like what he remembered the old album sounding like. Oh. I don't know if that makes sense, but I don't know if you know that, but, like, that feeling when it's like, okay, like, there's a song I love that I remember when I heard it, it was, like, so visceral, or it just, yeah, hit me in a certain way. But when you listen, like, you know, if you play it for someone 10 years or 15 years younger than you, it will sound like old and dated to them, because for just, you know, the way it was produced or everything that's evolved since then will sound more, for all the things that have evolved from it will sound more, you know, legit to them oftentimes. Not always. But in some cases, it's just like technical limitations, you know? So to me, that was kind of the idea behind working with Lee. So we had worked up a lot of the music already and knew that people were feeling it because we were playing it in the shows. So we kind of recorded, you know, redid parts that, you know, rather than use samples and things, we redid every element of the album. And then I actually went down to Jamaica, and we planned to go to the studio. It was interesting you asked what it was like being in the studio, because there are a handful of times we did go and record some stuff in the studio. But for this album, he knew I had this whole setup that I basically build a studio on stage every night for the show. So the first night I was there, he said, yeah, set up all the stuff right here in the house, in the kitchen table, and let's, like, listen to things. I had a little speaker. I was kind of prepared for that anyway, because I knew he liked that kind of situation. And we ended up, it was so comfortable there, we basically would record like 14 hours a day for like nine days straight. From, like, he would knock on my, like, bedroom door at his house. I was staying in his house in the morning and be like, yo, you ready? Like, let's go. I've got ideas already. And then just go take pauses for meals. He's, like, by the water, so maybe, like, go in the water for a little bit and come back, and then just be going until, like, late night. You know, sometimes people would come by the house and they'd be, like, you know, rolling up spliffs, and he wanted to, like, play the songs for people and things like that. So we actually recorded probably like 4 or 5 albums worth of material, but we put out the one album, and then, you know, a lot of the things we're working on, I haven't put out. He passed away, and, you know, it was kind of a crazy time. And I also didn't want to put out stuff like seizing on his death. You know, a lot of people, there was almost like a rush of people doing it because it was sort of so unregulated, and it was just really kind of like crass to me. I didn't like that, you know. I want his memory to live on, but I didn't want to feel like, you know.
A vulture or something. I get you totally. I'm not. We got so much to talk about. We got to talk about Ari Up. We definitely got to talk about Michael Rosen, the new album. But I got two last Loose Scratch Perry questions for you. Then we'll play a song. We'll come back. We'll talk about Ari Up. We'll talk about Michael Rosen, the brand new album, Rocking Like a Champion. One. I'm going to tell Miley. And actually, Ems, do you have? I was planning to do an hour, but we got so much to talk. Can you do like an hour 15 or so? I got so much I want to talk about here.
No problem, man. We could cut it up into two if you want, man.
Not a bad idea. So I'm gonna tell one of my favorite, but I guess also kind of most distressing Lee Scratch Perry stories. I saw Lee Scratch Perry live 14 times. The two best times I saw him. First time I saw him was with Dub as a Weapon in Philadelphia, 2006 or 2007. It was like a 14-piece band, and it was amazing. Other tied for the best time I saw him was at the Ardmore Music Hall, Lee Scratch Perry with Subatomic Sound System on the Super Ape Redux tour, if you will, which was after Larry McDonald was there. You were behind the deck. They had the young lady singing, the guy on the saxophone. It was great. But
Nice.
one of the not so good times, it was all right. It was at Moe's Alley in Santa Cruz. And it was really, and Moe's Alley in Santa Cruz is a pretty cool venue. They have a lot of legacy reggae acts there. I saw
Sure.
Abyssinians
We played there.
there.
It's sort of the spot in Santa Cruz. I remember the first time we pulled up there, and it was like a gravel parking lot, and it was looking behind some warehouses. I was looking at the map, and I was like, "Nah, this is not the place. Like, this map must be wrong." And I thought it was like a Google Maps error. And then we saw like our name on like on a little sign, and I was like, "Oh, what? Like, no, this is gonna be a disaster." But then it was like actually a great time. Usually, it's like a usually a really good vibe there. But what? Tell me about your story, man. What happened?
So it was Lee Perry was obviously like a put together band. It was like three American guys, and they played like all the hits, and it was all right. But the crowd was very high, and I'm gonna come off as kind of a dick, is I felt the crowd was enjoying Perry as a novelty rather than as an incredibly important artist. And people were like getting up on stage and messing with the instruments, which I thought was really weird at any show. Perry seemed to think that was amusing and like that. And then there's this one guy that was clearly like I've never seen it. I'm pretty sure it was LSD or something. This guy was backstroking across the stage, no water, mind you.
I've heard of this. I heard this story before.
He's backstroking across the stage. He goes between Perry's legs, and Perry thinks it's hilarious. But then he gets up and he kisses Perry on the cheek, and Perry doesn't like that at all. Which I can
No.
no one wants someone kissing them. You know what I mean? And
This
so
is too
then
far.
he like freaks out. Well, actually, I don't know if he freaks out, but he gets angry and he's going, you bombo, blah, blah, blah. Like all this very heavy Jamaican patois curses, right? And the crowd doesn't know that's what he's saying. And they're like, they're all
Cheering.
going like, Ja, Ja, you know, Irie, Irie. And he was like getting madder and madder. And the crowd thinks he's like celebrating or, you know what I mean? And he's literally saying, F you, I hate you all. Like he's literally saying, like, fuck you know, I hate you know. And then the show really kind of crashed it to an end.
Disintegrated,
And so my question is, do you know, did Lee feel as though the North American audience appreciated him, or did he feel as though, because like Miles Davis famously was annoyed by much of his audience in the 70s and 80s, you know? Do you know what Lee Perry's perspective was?
No, to be honest, I think he really he loved people, and he loved the people who would come out to see him. And you know, there were occasionally nights where people that kind of thing would happen, where some people would just be too wasted and acting up. But I kind of know about like. That tour was, I think, just before we started working with him. And that, I saw a show that was kind of like that. It might have even been that tour that was just kind of, it was like a little bit disappointing, you know? And I think, like, just, it's one thing for Beale to go up there and play the music. But sometimes, like, Lee, if he doesn't have chemistry with the people performing or engage with the music, the show doesn't really pull you in. And I remember that was like a disagreement at the time with, like, the tour manager. I remember him saying, like, it doesn't matter what band Lee's with. It's like people are there to see Lee, and he could be up there with, you know, just some people banging on Tupperware, and it would be brilliant. And I remember saying like, nah, you know, like that's you don't like that's not it. You know, this is not like performance art. Like he has a whole legacy of music that I think the thing that was confusing about him was for people who came knowing that he was the guy who wrote and produced all the early like Bob Marley stuff, or all, you know, hits like Sun Is Shining and Kaya and all these tunes that they knew, and coming expecting they were going to get like a Bob Marley show, and instead having him go up and just do like spoken word, or, you know, be like one song, just not sing at all, just dig through his like magic suitcase and, you know, pull out like paintbrushes and things like that. But for the most part, like, I found that as we toured with him, first of all, like, the shows kept getting better, the crowds were getting bigger, the people were started to become like more plugged in to his wavelength. So I felt like, you know, there was there had to be like chemistry between him and the crowd. And there were, to me, I always said, like, no matter what happened with him with a show, you know, because sometimes he would do things that were odd to most people, like there'd be times that he would just want to play one song for like half an hour, or play Sun Is Shining in particular, that song, like, some, we once played it like four times in the same show, once like twice back to back, you know. And a lot of times he just sang the lyrics to like Sun Is Shining or another song over like four or five different songs. And people would think, oh, he's like drunk, or he doesn't know what he's doing, or he's like senile or something. But it wasn't that. It was just like he literally, like I said, is just like, to me, the most punk rock guy. He's just going to do exactly what he wanted to do. In fact, he once told me he would never sing a song the same way twice, because if he did, it would be a lie. Because you should only be singing what you're feeling in that moment. So if you're not feeling that way, you know, when you wrote a song, you were feeling a certain way. You're never going to feel exactly the same way again. You know, you can be in that sort of zone, but you should always sing it the way you're feeling at that moment. Otherwise, it won't be authentic, you know. So I think that was it. You know, it's like he definitely appreciated. He often said that the Jamaicans didn't appreciate him as much as, like, audiences outside of Jamaica, you know. So I don't think he was discouraged. He definitely wasn't like a Miles Davis who was like disgusted by his, you know, who his fans were. I think it was the opposite. He kind of loved, he used to say too, he loved crazy people, you know. So he appreciated when someone would come and do crazy stuff to a certain extent.
Well, there you have it. Lee Scratch Perry, the most punk rock, and also you sing the same song twice. Unlike, isn't that a Wailer song? It's a song so nice I want to sing it twice. Lee Perry, you never sing the song twice. Exactly. So anyways, let's play a Subatomic and Lee Perry song, and we'll be back, and we'll talk about Ari Up, and we'll talk about the brand new album with Michael Rose, and we'll be right back.
Right on.
Now. I've got your fire. It's electric wire. Get down now and get down. Just bump, 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 bump. Dracula, we gone. I'm a little killer with Rose Khan. Dracula, we gone. I wanna kill her before the dawn. Vampire, get out of me here. Vampire, save me here. I'm a little killer with Rose Khan.
And we are back. Boom. Ari Up, another punky reggae genius, super unique person. How'd you hook up with Ari Up? Did you feel as though Ari Up was a genius? And was working with Ari Up very difficult, as many people have said?
Yeah, all of those things are true. All of those things are true. And, man, I'm trying to figure out how I first linked up with her. It was in New York, and I know I was friends with Agent J, and she was – they had that Ari Up and the New Warriors or something like that. It was a band that he was in. They were rehearsing in the basement of Jammyland Records, which was just a few blocks down from my place in the East Village. I think at one point, I don't know if this was the first time I met her, but I was coming out of a movie theater on 3rd Avenue. And she was just walking by with some people. And I think I just called her name because I recognized her. Obviously, she's a very distinctive person. She had, like, you know, the time, most of her life, had these really thick dreadlocks, like almost down to her waist or knees. And, you know, had kind of a crazy accent too, because it was like British, but mixed with, you know, I think she was originally born in Germany and stuff. Her mom's German stuff.
Yeah, like
it was like a weird Jamaican German British accent. So yeah, I think I just shouted her name. Like, she's walking right past me, and she turned and, you know, gave me a look with like her crazy eyes, and I was like, "Hey, what's up?" And I don't know if I said, "Oh, I've met you before. I'm friends with so and so," or whatever. But we started talking, and I remember she started like disparaging someone I knew, who later was real upset about it. Just he was like, "I can't believe she said that about me for no reason." But anyway, she, I don't know if we traded numbers or something. I don't know if we even had like a cell phone back then. But yeah, somehow she said, oh, you know, yeah, I know about you. I want to, let's stay in touch. And so we started talking, and I think I must have had a cell phone because that was probably, she was putting like the slit stuff together, and she wanted me to mix some things. I remember she came over to my apartment and was playing me some music, new slit stuff. And at one point, I remember I was doing like a dub mix for a song. It was Dennis Brown's Revolution. They did a cover of it. It's called Slits Revolution. It never came out either, sadly. But yeah, and then I just stayed in touch with her. And then when Paul from Double Standard came over, I think he was actually like, oh, let's have her sit in with us when we play with Lee. And at first, I think Lee wasn't sure about it. I think he didn't want to do it, but she did end up sitting in and playing with us at that first show. And then at Summer Stage, she didn't sit in on the set with Lee, but she did come sing some songs with us with Double Standard. Or this was Double Standard, I was playing guitar for them and melodica and stuff. But yeah, man, I mean, that was the thing with her, is she was at first I liked Ari, but then she was like a lot, you know. She was always talking and kind of had to be the center of attention. But at the same time, she always had like interesting stuff to say too, you know. I think I originally said like I thought it was gonna be too much to deal with her and Lee at the same time. And I thought like we shouldn't have her there. And I'm glad that I got like overruled because it ended up being cool. And I also didn't know that at the time she's coming by, and then we start recording some songs. We recorded some songs for Double Standard for I don't know if it was the Planet Dub album or it came out on a later album, but it was after she recorded stuff with them. She wanted to record some stuff on one of my songs, and I think that she heard the Perry tune and was like, I've never been on a tune with Perry before, and she wanted to do the Bette Athleate's tune, and then kind of like flip that into the Hell Is Very Low song. And then that was kind of the jump off for being like, okay, well, you just got to be at the, you know, at the show and all that. But yeah, you know, like one of the amazing things that about her too is she would come over. Every time she'd come over, she would have like an amazing matching outfit that was like, you couldn't even really describe what it was. It was just like cloth, like all over on different parts of her body. And it was like, what is that? Like a dress or as a hat that's the same. It would be all like its own fabric. And I remember at one point talking to her about it, and she told me how she sewed all of her own clothes, like all of her own stuff. And that was interesting to me because it was just one of those signs that like everything she did was just like she was doing it her own way, you know, from her approach to like music to the way she dressed to just her whole attitude. But you know, I think that one of the things that was difficult with people like Ari and Lee was that they're a little bit in their own world, almost like little kids on acid or something. They were just in their own world, and they were so creative, and so they'd easily get frustrated with people when, you know, like when you're dealing with a little kid and you're like, okay, like we got to go now, or like, you know, just dealing with practical things. They would sometimes almost like throw tantrums and get hostile and angry, and then have confrontations with people. And you know, sometimes that can be exhausting. A lot of people don't want to put up with that. But you know, if you're like a, I don't want to say like a parent with a kid, but you know, when you got love for someone and you enjoy the good time, sometimes you're willing to put up with that kind of stuff, and sometimes you kind of figure out like ways to work around it too, I guess. It helps when everyone's like on the same page.
Well, definitely everyone should check out the Hell Is Very Low Bette Athleate 7-inch, which you can still track down. It's kind of hard to find, but you can still track it down. And honestly, it's one of Ari Up's best solo singles. I guess one last question about Ari Up, and maybe you don't have an answer for this. Does Ari Up know that Ari Up is Ari Up? In that, like, I'm trying to think of an example. Like, KRS-One, he's a maniac, right? He's not playing a character. He's my favorite MC. He really is far out. Like, he's not playing a character. That's who he is, you know. But like Peter Murphy of Bauhaus, when he's up there and he's singing about goth, and like, that's not the real Peter Murphy. The real Peter Murphy isn't he's weird, but he's not the weird guy you see on stage, you know?
Yeah.
So when Ari Up says these outrageous things, you know, when she does these outrageous things, when she starts just talking smack for no apparent reason.
Yeah.
Does she know what she's doing, or is Lily, is that pure impulse? You know what I mean?
Man, I don't know if I know her as well as other people well enough to speak on that. But I mean, my feeling when I first was spending time with her was, it was sometimes she was like intentionally outrageous to get a rise out of people. You know what I mean? And sometimes that could feel like tiresome. But in the end, I feel that she, you know, she had like a bit of a chip on her shoulder too. Like she really oftentimes wanted to make the point about, you know, how much they got overlooked and overshadowed because they were women, and their contribution to music at that time, like they were so creative. And it is like, I think that she has a legitimate claim to that, that there's no doubt that like the things they did, when there's a really interesting documentary on the Slits, and even, you know, after it sort of took on some different incarnations, and like Nana Cherry was in the band, they did this stuff that was almost like early proto like world music, like all that stuff was so innovative, and they just they were like ahead of their time, you know. And that was one of my feelings about Scratch too, was that he was a guy who was ahead of his time, and that's exactly why it was, you know, important to do work with him, to connect him with like a younger audience, because I wanted to see him get his due, because he, you know, the people who did feel he was important, he was so important too, you know, and myself included. And I just thought, man, it would be so great for a younger generation who's maybe caught up to his ideas to experience those and like appreciate him. I'd love to see him get his appreciation. And I felt a similar way about Ari. And sadly, one of the things they talk about in the Slits documentary is the last tour they do there, she was difficult. A lot of people, you know, some people quit the band and were like frustrated with her, but she didn't tell anyone towards the end that she actually had cancer and was gonna die. And I didn't know that either. So, man, it's just thinking back on those times, like the last few times I spent with her, really positive. And she actually was like, shoot a video. I want to like say some things. It was almost like she left like messages as like a time capsule to people, which I really should dig up. But I remember like the last time I saw her, she was leaving, and I was like, I don't, you know, I felt like she was like really talking about a lot of stuff, because I figured I was just going to see her again like a week later. But she ended up going to the hospital, and the record was done, and we were trying to plan some shows together, and she was like, yeah, we're gonna do the shows. But then eventually it was like, oh, I'm in the hospital right now, so we can't do this show. And then she was like, I'm in the hospital and I'm probably not coming out. And I was like, what? And that's when I was like shocked, you know. So yeah, that's I forgot what the question was, and I don't know if I gave you an answer. But basically, you know, Ari Up, was she self-aware about who she was? I think that, yeah, I mean, sometimes she was and sometimes she wasn't. And even Scratch, you know, a lot of people say with Scratch, like him being crazy, oh, is Scratch really crazy? I was like, there were certainly things he did that he didn't even think anyone was looking or watching him. There's his own rituals that by anyone else's standards were crazy. But there were certainly times when he didn't want to deal with people where he would be like, fuck it, I'm going to act crazy as, you know, he could be, just to like drive people away. And I think he's admitted to that as well. Doesn't mean he's not crazy either though. You know what I mean?
Well, that actually brings us to the Michael Rowe section. There's an interesting parallel between Subatomic Sound System and On You Sound. Oh, and actually, I want to backtrack very quickly. For Ari Up fans, in addition to the fantastic Subatomic Sound System single, if you're an Ari Up fan or Slits fan, there is a ton of rare but really good solo Ari Ups, she got a solo album, but she also has these singles in Jamaica as Baby Whitey and Baby Ari. Also, and we're going to talk about Ari in a second, she was in a group called New Age Steppers, which is amazing. Plus, she did this album with the Slackers that you can only get in Japan, or was only pressed in Japan. So there's a whole bunch of, and I'm feeling there's a bunch of Ari Up stuff that is under some other name that no one has realized is Ari Up. Like,
she had a dance hall project and she used the name Medusa.
Well, I don't even know about that, so I'll have to track that down. I mean, I sound for it.
Yeah.
So I will. So anyways, there's a really interesting parallel between Subatomic Sound System and On You Sound System. On You Sound System is a record label production creation studio founded by Adrian Sherwood in the late 70s, early 80s. And his thing then and now was he would take legendary or contemporary reggae artists and give it kind of the UK post-punk treatment and make this really cool, spacey reggae, which was kind of like, I don't know, reggae to the next level, at least from an English standpoint. And if you're a fan, check out his group Singers and Players, New Age Steppers, his work with Lee Scratch Perry, a lot of really, really amazing albums. But one thing that I think Sherwood had to maneuver around, and I think maybe you do too, and that, like, you've got all these amazing records with, you know, Lee Scratch Perry, Ari Up, Screechy Dan, Michael Rose, Max Anthony Romeo, B. worked with Anthony B. Is there's this, I don't know if weird is the right word, but there's been to a degree this contentious relationship between Jamaican artists and UK and maybe even USA record labels, because a lot of these Jamaican guys sold hundreds of thousands or millions of records. And they're getting like $40, you know what I mean? And so there's a famous Playboy article where some guy goes down to Jamaica to talk to Bunny Wailer, and Bunny Wailer's jerking him around, and the guy seems to think the reason is because Bunny Wailer is distrustful of white people from England because of so many Jamaican artists have been ripped off, you know? So Adrian Sherwood kind of has to walk this line between collaboration, paying tribute to, but not exploiting Jamaican artists, you know? Do you feel that challenge, or are you like, I'm in it for the right reasons, so, you know?
No, I don't think, because, you know, it's like, I was working for Lee Perry, you know? Mm-hmm. I was, you know, he was hiring us in that case, you know? He wanted at the time to work with non-Jamaican artists. I mean, before Scratch, we did put out stuff with like Anthony B and Elephant Man. I went down to Jamaica and recorded that. I mean, you know, there definitely, I think, are a lot of parallels between On You Sound and Subatomic Sound, as you described in the approach. But I don't think, like, the business situation you described is necessarily true for either of our labels. Because I think, you know, in the UK, there's just a huge population of Jamaicans there. So I think with Adrian, a lot of people, including, like, you know, Style Scott, they came to him, and he started out, you know, running the Pressure Sounds label when he was like really young, like a teenager. Like, I can't remember what he told me when he was like, you know, 14. It was something crazy where I was like, what, how are you even like traveling around to shows and like getting involved with selling records? But he was like 14 riding around in a van, like trying to sell like Jamaican, you know, just authentic Jamaican records. And he got into production from there. Like, that's a different path for me. We kind of had different paths going into it, but when we ended up getting to the point of producing and working on music, I think we both had a similar approach of trying to do something different rather than just trying to emulate Jamaican reggae exactly. Like, try and take elements of what we had coming up, you know, from different genres of music, and combine it with what we thought was cool about reggae to make something that had elements that, you know, just maybe related to a different audience or a wider audience, you know, and try not to alienate the original audience. You know, I guess that's been like one of our goals, is to like incorporate elements that are not traditionally in Jamaican reggae, but not in a way that is, you know, like when there's a whole era of like rock rap bands where they just like cut and paste like heavy metal and rapping together because they thought some people would like that. But really, people who liked either of those genres pretty much hated it, you know, because it was just corny. You know, sorry if anyone out there is one of those people, but, you know, not down with Limp Bizkit. I never will be. But Adrian's older than me, and he was like, this, before we're done talking about REP, I have to say that in those final conversations, she said to me, she's like, you need to connect with Adrian Sherwood, because she was surprised I'd never met him. And she was like, I'm going to connect you guys, and you have to bring him here to New York. And so after she passed, actually, that's one of the things I did. I reached out to him and I said, I'm trying to put together this dub festival, and REP told me I got to connect with you and bring you over here. And he was like, all right, let's do it. And at the time, we didn't really have the money that he needed to come over, but he was like, let's do it, you know, and make this happen. And he's a great person. I think certainly not just to me, but to a lot of people he's worked with. He's like a mentor. He's like full of like good advice, just like, certainly, like, all my work with Lee, I don't think would have gone as smoothly as it did if he didn't tell me about his experience with Lee and the problems he had with Lee, and, say, you know, getting along with Lee's wife, Miri, who's also, like, you know, got a certain way of doing things, and a lot of people don't get along with her. So knowing about them and, you know, how to deal with them in a harmonious way is really what like laid the foundation for us to work together for so long. And I haven't been in touch with Adrian as much recently, sadly, but I think about him all the time. I'm gonna reach out to him after this podcast.
I think you should. But now you're working with one of the greatest singers in all of reggae, Michael Rose, who, and if people haven't checked it, like, his pre Black Uhuru singles are actually also super excellent. Yeah. And Black Uhuru, one of the greatest reggae groups of all time, first reggae group to win a Grammy, as Yellow Man famously says. But I will say, after Black Uhuru, and MC, you don't even have to respond to this, his solo albums to me are very hit or miss. He's got some incredible singles, including not Police and Thieves, Shootout, which is an amazing single.
Amazing song, yeah.
But I'm so honestly, I'm thrilled and excited and very pleased that Emsh has recorded this Rocking Like a Champion album, because to me, finally, the Michael Rose solo has achieved what it's been promising for, what, 30 years now? It's definitely his best. Not that records need to be compared against each other, but it's his best solo album, if you ask me. As a fan, it's exactly what I want. It's contemporary, but it pays homage to the classic Michael Rose sound. Michael himself sounds awesome. I don't know if you want me to kick it off or not. I've seen Michael Rose 3 times. He's amazing live. Well, actually, I will kick it off. He's amazing live. And you feel free to, in my perspective, might be totally wrong. He's amazing live. But all 3 times I've seen him, he gets up there, and last time I saw him was in Philadelphia. It was in the middle of summer. It was hot in the Watts warehouse. Hot. Mm-hmm. He's got on an undershirt, a dress shirt, a jacket, and he's all bundled up. And I'm like, how is he not on fire? And the whole show, he wears these dark, cool guy glasses. Actually, it was him. It was supposed to be him, Sly, and Robbie. But was it Robbie that sadly got sick? So it was Roy Parks instead. So it was still pretty cool, actually. Though. Michael, Sly, and Lloyd Parks, which was pretty cool. And he sounded, and what was really cool is they did mostly Black Uhuru stuff, but every song was like extended into like a mega dub version at the end, which was cool, totally. Or disco mix, if you will. Yep. But the whole show, Michael, he sounds amazing. He's just staring at the audience like he hates you. And I feel like, feel free to, I feel like maybe he hates white people, because I'm seeing him, I'm like, wow, he's like super intense. Like, this is like the most intense reggae artist I've ever seen. He's just like staring at everyone with like a 40-yard stare, whatever they call that. And I'm like, wow, he's like really intense. And then I see a video of him in Jamaica, and he's like laughing and smiling and dancing around the stage. I'm like, oh man, does he just like hate every, like, so what's your amazing
record? Oh man, what's your experience? He is super intense. He's very intense, and he's a very emotional person. You know, when someone's at a really high level of creativity, I feel like they do not they don't necessarily fit in with people's expectations of how they should be at a given time. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like, if it's like, oh, you're at you're at a show, you should be happy and you're in a good mood. It's like, if they're just such a highly like emotional person that if they're in a bad mood, like no matter what else is going on, like they'll be in that mood and you just got to deal with it. And if they're in a great mood, you know, worst things could be happening and they're like unaffected. And I would say he's kind of like, yeah, he's like a very emotional person. And when he's in great mood, he's in great mood. When he's not, like, you know, maybe it will come across that way. But I think it had anything to do with the audience or anything like that. You know, he's just got, you know why I had to turn this mic up when we started the podcast? I actually plugged into the channel here on my system, which the last time I had it plugged in was when we were performing. And he sings so loud. The first couple times we performed, I was like, what's going on? Because it was like coming through my, like distorting so badly. And I had to turn everything way down. I kept thinking, I don't know, it was just like some mistake had happened. And I just realized, I actually talked to him. I was like, what's the microphone you're using? Like, are you using a microphone that's like a, somehow like a different level than what? No, it was a normal microphone. He's just like, his voice, it's just like, it's like a lion roaring, you know, he's just got like so much energy in him. So there's that, you know, to bring it back full circle, the crazy thing about Michael is that when we were introduced, it was after Lee Perry passed, we were introduced by Lenny Chen, who's the manager for the Wailers, who had been like a great friend of Bob's for a long time and knew Michael from way back. And it turns out when I started talking to Michael that Michael's first song he ever recorded as a teenager was with Lee at the Black Ark. He would go by the Black Ark with Junior Delgado. Yeah. And one day he was asking Lee to record and Lee was brushing him off, and Lee's wife at the time was like, Lee, give him a chance. Let him sing a song. His voice sounds nice. So he did a song called Observe Life, which is out. You can find it on YouTube. And that was like, yeah, supposedly the first song he ever recorded. So that was crazy right off the bat. Like when we met, we had that connection. And of course, like, when we've met to do a show, and so Larry McDonald was with me and they hit it off because they both know Sly, and everything was just like, yeah, super, super positive. And kind of right from the get-go, that's when I realized, like, wow, we can really do this thing. And I also started to realize, as we were talking about music and dub, I mean, I knew, like, of course, Sly and Robbie, their whole dub thing, but I didn't realize how much, like, live Black Uhuru would do those extended dub sections. I knew it was like on the albums and stuff, but I was listening to old recordings of them, and that was really a big thing for them. And I started to realize, like, wow, there's very few singers who understand that as well as Michael. And he was doing like a live dub sort of performance so far back, like the early 80s, you know. But one thing I have to say is that Larry McDonald was joking when we first met Michael about how he remembers seeing Black Uhuru for the first time in, you know, I don't know if that was like 1980 or whatever. They're playing Sunsplash in Jamaica. And of course it was like 90 degrees. And back to your story about seeing Michael live, he's like, yo, you guys came out and it was like 90 degree weather, it's crazy humidity. And everyone was dressed head to toe in full leather suits and hats and sunglasses. And he's like, I remember the music, but what I remember more is the whole time wondering how they're up there performing in the heat with all that leather on and no one's passing out and falling on the stage. It might even been like 100 degrees or something in Jamaica heat with the humidity and everything. Man, that's crazy. It was the daytime too, I think. So yeah, I mean, all those things you said, I think are accurate. You know, like he's like an amazing talent, obviously. And kind of like with Lee, I felt, you know, I mean, he left Black Uhuru by choice, but I put a lot of work into the album. Like he, in interviews, has said to people like, oh yeah, we recorded in like 3 or 4 days, then Emch came back and did a touch up. But like, I spent a lot of time in between seeing him, going to his studio and going recording me and Larry and Troy. Like I brought a lot of stuff down to him that was sort of unfinished because I wanted to hear what he liked and what he was going to do and then build around it. That's how I like to work, which is very different than in the world of like reggae music. It's very common, a little bit back to your story about the reggae business, it's very common for people to just fly down to Jamaica, or not even fly down these days with the computer, just send through the computer completed music to a singer and be like, go to the studio and record this and I'll send you a chunk of money. And it just works like that. Like, unless the song does really well, the singers don't even expect really to see money after that. I guess nowadays it's changed. Now people track things more. But back in the day, it was like people just paid like a flat fee. And that's even how it worked. Like, the business of music in Jamaica, they just really didn't track royalties. And even copyright was not a thing, which is why, like, one of the things that happened in reggae music that is literally not able to happen in any other genres of music outside of Jamaica because of the law of copyright, is that it, no one tracked. Like, if you wrote a song, I'm trying to think of maybe a song, an easy song that most people would know, like Bomb Bomb by Sister Nancy, or Ring the Alarm by Tenor Saw. Ring the alarm, another sound is dying. Or what the bomb, 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 bomb. Those songs are over the same music, okay? It's called the Stalag rhythm. There are about 100 songs over the Stalag rhythm, and there are several other popular Jamaican rhythms that are like that. But almost every Jamaican rhythm that's been on any hit song has multiple versions. People will use sometimes the same music and put a different vocal over it, or they'll just re-record it without permission and do their own song on it years later, or even immediately when the other song's out, which would oftentimes lead to like confrontations and like fights and, you know, even like gunshots. But there wasn't actually a law against that. It wasn't illegal there. There was no copyright law until maybe like 10 years ago in Jamaica. They started like putting this stuff into place. So, I forget how I got onto that tangent, but I think it's a really interesting thing to note in the way like the music developed there, and you know, just how different people's approach is to like the business of music in Jamaica. I guess my point was with Michael, I remember he was actually surprised when I was like, yeah, I want to come down. He has a studio in his house, which I love, because I have a studio built in my place. Every, you know, even now that I'm in Cali, when I go back to New York, like sometimes we'll go to a studio there, but a lot of times I'll go to Larry McDonald's house. So some of our best sessions we recorded right in his house. He'll mix up some rum punch, roll up some spliff, and then, you know, we're off and just record for hours. And then I'll go over to Brooklyn to Troy's place and we'll record horns over there. And it's just, I like to do it that way, you know, and it's like it's relaxed and there's a like chemistry there. So yeah, Michael was a little surprised I want to come down. Then I want to come back again. He was like, what's up with this guy? But in the end, he was like, yo, this sounds really good. Like, he's like, I know you really put work into this. So, that's the thing. A lot of people just don't put the level of work into things these days. First of all, you know, back in the day when it was a band, something like Black Uhuru with guys like Sly and Robbie, like, you know, they were out playing as a band and they were refining the music, you know. But these days, with so many people recording, just like putting music together on the computer, it's like they don't really rehearse it or even like play the music out live a lot before it's recorded. Oftentimes it's recorded first and then they're out playing it. So with Michael, we did some shows first, playing mostly like his music, but we kind of had done elements of the music that's on the album that we played with him to make sure it was like hitting and he was feeling it and the audience was feeling it before we kind of morphed those into new songs and then started shaping it from there, you know. And I think like my process, it's everyone's strength is like a double-edged sword, you know. For me, I'm like really meticulous and take a lot of time to do things, but it's also the reason we put out so little music over the years. And it's so opposite of what the music business wants. Like, we're so contrary to that. Music business wants you to just like slap stuff together and put together an album in, you know, 2 days and put it out, and then put out another one next week, or, you know, that's, That's what they're like pressure, and they don't want to spend money to like promote things and this and that. It's just, you know, or there's no longer the idea that you're going to spend like 50 grand on a video, like it's a little movie or something. People just don't want to do that. It's just like, yeah, just shoot some things on your phone. And, you know, so we actually did shoot some music video stuff. We just did a show at the Hollywood Bowl and got all video of that. I'm like putting together so people can get an idea of seeing like what the performance of it looks like. Cause I think that's important too, cause it's a very like unusual format of the band.
Indeed. So except the new record is great. And also Holly Cook. So how'd you link up with Holly Cook? And you know, people often mention that she's the daughter of Paul Cook, but is that fair to mention? Because I mean, I didn't know that.
No, I mean, I knew it now, but I didn't know that until, like, I don't know, like maybe 2 years ago or something like that, which is funny. I just knew her from the Slits. So I know you were talking about her having a reggae career, but like, I always think of her as like, I thought of her as punk because she was part of this, the incarnation of Slits. I met her and I was saying to her, I didn't even realize when I'd met her, it was a show for the CMJ Music Marathon in New York at a club called the called Lit, that a friend of mine ran that place, and it was around the corner from my spot, and I'd sometimes do sound there. So I think I even went, and maybe I don't think I was supposed to do sound that night, but I think I helped with the sound, and I thought it was gonna be Ari and the band, but it was just her and Holly. And they had like these backing tracks, like these kind of electronic, like dance hall tracks. And it was cool. And she had like a crazy outfit on that almost looked like, I want to say like a Muppet, but the fabric was like something almost like a puppet would have been made out of. And that was just her and Holly. And I remember I met Holly that night and she was like kind of quiet and shy. I just thought she was really shy, which she claims she is shy, but I also didn't know she was like 18 or something at the time. She was like really young. And then Ari passed away, and there was a big show to commemorate her passing because it kind of took everyone off guard. So it was in Brooklyn, and Holly came, and Nana Cherry came too, who had been in the Slits. And I think I heard Ari say one time that Holly – when she met Holly, Holly was like the age Nana Cherry was when she met Nana Cherry or something like that. And then Nana Cherry joined the Slits. So I think she kind of felt like parallels. I know they had like a real close relationship, like, you know, friendship, but, you know, like a mentorish sort of thing. So anyway, I stayed in touch with Holly after that. And I remember seeing her a few times. She came over to do shows and just said hi. At one point, someone had asked us about doing a dub mix of one of her albums, but then I think Prince Fatty ended up doing it, who had produced the album originally. And then at another point, someone asked us if we wanted to be her band for some shows in New York, but then they ended up deciding they wanted to do a live band so it would sound a lot more like the album. And then I don't know, I just, yeah, I went to her shows, I became friendly with some of the guys in her band, and, you know, kept seeing her and talked about working together on things over the years. I remember she'd done some work with Adrian and Lee, so we're talking about Lee Perry and whatnot. And then I told her I was doing this thing with Michael and had the idea. I think I had even sent her one of the rhythms. There's a tune called Forward on the album that I had sent to her a few years before. Because we were talking about doing some music together, and she just didn't get around to it. You know, that happens. You know, it's like these days, it's like everyone talks about doing stuff, but sometimes, like, you know, following through, unless you're like really working together in the same place, a lot of times it just doesn't happen. So anyway, it hadn't happened. And then I played that song for Michael. I played the rhythm for Michael, and he like wrote this great song like immediately. And right after he recorded it, we were talking about backing vocals. I was asking him about Puma or something like that. And he was talking to me about how she had such a unique voice when he met her, that it was like opera. Or even that he told her he wanted her to sing like like opera. And I was just thinking about, yeah, you know, it's like her that element of her voice in Black Uhuru was such a great contrast to Michael, and it was such a unique style of backing vocals, because so often it was actually singing like in unison with him, you know, instead of like the call and response or more like R&B style vocals. I was like, that was really unique. And then it clicked in my head. I was like, you know, it's funny because this rhythm we just recorded on, this woman, Holly Cook, that I'm friends with, I originally put this together for her, and she actually has a really unique, high, ethereal voice. And I was also, in my mind, I was actually thinking, God, it's kind of crazy because she kind of looks like Puma Jones. And I said to Michael, like, oh, what do you think about putting some vocals like that on this track? And he was like, yeah, man, go ahead, try it out. And so, yeah, so I talked to her about it, and then back and forth, I thought it wasn't going to work out because we were meaning to have the album done a lot sooner. And then she wasn't able to get to it and was off doing some things. And then she ended up coming to the US for some shows, and it just worked out that we're able to cross paths and be in the same place at the same time. And she came through and we spent a couple days just chilling out, vibing, really relaxed, like played through the tunes, recorded a bunch of stuff, or just having a good time. And that was it. It was great. So it's, you know, one of those things where everything really happened like naturally, you know, and over time, which I think a lot of things don't happen that way these days. You know, they're kind of like, things happen quickly, or they're forced, or they're rushed, or people want a feature for someone and they just send them a track and it gets like emailed back to them, you know? So I was really happy that everything was able to kind of come together in a very like personal way and you know, materialize over time.
Well, the new record, Rocking Like a Champion, is super great. I guess last question, will there be a tour with Michael Rose, especially a East Coast USA tour?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that we're actually planning to have a tour this month, and our booking agent just didn't book it. That's literally what it comes down to. So we actually are just, yeah, we're not working with him anymore. So that's what happened there. But we've done a handful of shows. Like I said, we just did this show at Hollywood Bowl, which was right after the album came out. And that was amazing to get to do a show like that. Steven and Damian Marley invited us to do the show. And we've done like a handful of shows with them already. It's interesting, you know, someone like Michael, one thing I've learned too is like his importance to a whole generation of Jamaicans. Like, you know, Damian and Steven literally just like said to me like how much of an influence he was on them growing up, you know, which is interesting with them, you know, coming up obviously with who their dad is and how influential he was. But they were like, yeah, when we were young, like, sure, there was like our dad, but yeah, like we were really, you know, we were into like Michael Rose and Black Uhuru. That's what's hot when we were kids in Jamaica, you know. And Damien's into like Supercat and all that, you know. It's like they absorbed all this different music, and you hear it. Like, I mean, obviously that Shootout song you mentioned with Michael Rose, like Damian Marley did a remix with him.
They
did video and stuff with it. And a lot of their tunes, a lot of their big tunes, like one of Stephen Marley's big tunes, Ja Army, is over a sample of the beat of General Penitentiary, Black Uhuru song. And Nail Pung Cross is over the rhythm for Solidarity, a Black Uhuru song. That was the single off Damien's like two albums ago. So yeah, so it's no joke. It's like it's cool to see that like connection across the generation. So they've been like really supportive, and I know they thought it was cool, like the format that we're doing and hearing him do new stuff as well. So it's like, it's kind of crazy to get that kind of feedback from guys like that, who I have like the utmost respect for as like artists and producers. Like, they're doing stuff at the highest level. So.
Well, very cool. And I'm glad to see that the fruits of your labor are so successful. Any last words, any closing words that you'd like listeners to, anything you want them to check out, anywhere you want them to go, anything you want them to buy, anything you want them to contemplate, closing words?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. At the end of your review of the album, which again, like I said, thank you for taking the time to, you know, listen and give like heartfelt responses. And, you know, like also someone like yourself who really understands like the history of this music. Like, I really appreciate that you put the history, you know, you even make those connections to like On You Sound. And for people who don't know like that, there's a whole other world they can dig into. But like, it's, I think these days it's hard for people to understand music in its context. When you say, oh, there's this guy, Michael Rose, people are like, who's that? Oh, Black Uhuru, he won the first Grammy. Oh, who, like, you know, like reggae is so underexposed in the US in general. And a lot of people find it in sort of a roundabout way. Like maybe both you and I came to it through, you know, interest in punk and the association with other music or musicians that we liked. And so I just feel like it's such a rich music that's inspired so many people and has, you know, so many talented artists and producers that are in many ways like underappreciated. And so first of all, thank you for, you know, giving it the exposure. You guys, you know, gave it like whatever critics pick and just the putting the spotlight on it to a different audience, you know, to the punk audience, who I think will appreciate the music, the spirit of the Rockin' Like a Champion album. But you also in that review were asking for physical copies. So here's the, I can tell you half the story. Physical copies are coming. Vinyl and CDs are coming. In fact, I'm literally holding the test press in my hand right now, but we're not able to officially announce it and tell you where to get it, except that it's coming on, like, let's just say a special day where these types of things come out. It's a little bit different than the digital release, like exclusive mixes and stuff. And it's going to be coming real soon. So we're going to have an announcement about that. Subatomicsound.com is our website, and that's where we'll be putting up like tour dates. We'll announce when like vinyl and the CDs will come out, and we can't put any of them out until this certain date, as will be revealed in time. But that's the story, and we're looking forward to playing the music live. We're going to post up some videos from the Hollywood Bowl, because a lot of people have been asking us like, oh, what's the live show going to be like? And it's, you know, kind of like you were mentioning when you saw Michael, like extended versions that have some dub and improvisation at the end, and you know, it's the same band that we played with for years with Lee Scratch Perry. So I think a lot of people are curious, like, you know, you mentioned like, is this going to be the same type of thing as what you did with Lee Perry? And it's, the answer is yes. And we're hoping to be able to do some shows with Holly as well. We're trying to get her over for the Hollywood Bowl show, but it didn't work out because we weren't able to get the other shows booked around then. But when we get something more extensive booked and some festival dates, we hope to get her in the mix too. And hopefully her whole band can come over and see, get to see them do some shows as well, because they're amazing also.
Well, extremely cool. Amps, thanks for coming on the show. Much appreciated. Congrats on the new record. Everyone really should go check out Rockin' Like a Champion. Michael Rose, Subatomic Sound System, and Holly Cook. Digital version out now. Physical version apparently out relatively soon. We're going to close this off with one of Ari Up's best solo tracks, as produced by Subatomic Sound System. This is Ari Up and Subatomic Sound System doing Bed Athletes. Amps, thanks again. And this has been a real blast. And here is one of Emp's many triumphs. This is Bed Athletes. We'll see you next week.
All right.
ring. Rule your length and all your strength in your hands and defense. Sex by prime and to learn why. Special design, mix combine. Expert technique, tell me which peak. Keep your physique on vibe each week. We are bed, 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 hot leash. We are bed, 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 hot leash. We are bed.
We are bed, bed.